just sit there facing the hill. Just say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused, and his brain has been mismanaged with great
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States Department of State's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has authored and co-authored and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Response to Globalization's Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. He has an article at the American Interest spinoff, The Syrian Crisis and the Future of Iraq. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And the President Bashar al-Assad addressed the Syrian people today from the Opera House in Damascus, and it was a speech full of defiance and delusion, but entirely devoid of any mention of a diplomatic possibility to end this war that's destroying Syria and has already claimed 60,000 lives. So are we therefore to expect more agony?
Well, yes. I mean, I think we shouldn't have expected anything else from Bashar al-Assad. I mean, essentially his regime is at stake. Whatever solution one ends up with in Syria will not include him, and he knows that. So he is going to try to survive and last until the very last moment. And he may very well end up dying in Syria, the way things are going at the moment. But he clearly doesn't understand how bad the situation is for him. It's getting worse by the day. It may still take months, maybe even a year, for him to finally lose power. But yes, you're right. There's going to be a lot more misery in Syria.
And I don't know whether you saw the video recently that was posted of the Shabiha, the pro-Assad militia, having captured some hapless prisoners. And they put 2 of them up against a wall and slowly slash them with knives, all the time yelling, exalting their great leader, the Lord Bashar. And then they, after slashing them, they start stabbing them in a very, I mean, it's impossible to, I'm still in shock having made the mistake of watching it. The notion that the Alawites could see the Sunni, their brother, their fellow Syrians, as nothing more than animals to be slaughtered. It's so disturbing and so hard to get your head around.
Well, we have to be careful. I mean, I started watching the video, but then I turned it off because I think it was very, very disturbing, and I'm very glad that I did not watch it. That said, there's an important point that has to be made here, and that is that not all Alawites are Shabiha. Not Alawites are killers. Not all Alawites are such depraved individuals as the ones that you saw on that video. So I think we have to be careful, and for the sake of Syria, and for the sake of, you know, for human beings in Syria, that in the end, whatever emerges out of this will not be a situation where the majority of the population then goes on and slaughters the minority. I mean, they're all Syrians in the end. Yes, this regime has cynically made use of the minority to suppress the majority, and unfortunately, members of this minority will have to pay a huge price. But it should not be one of vengeance and violence. There are serious efforts being made, by the way, if you look at even at today's press reports, of lists being made of only the top government officials who are responsible for the violence and who will be charged in the aftermath of the regime's fall, so that not everybody gets accused. And I think this is an effort that has to be supported by the outside powers, by everybody, and otherwise it will be very, very grim. And I think it's not in the interest of anybody to see revenge violence in the aftermath of the fall of the regime.
And is this idea of using a minority to dominate the majority, doesn't that come out of colonialism? The British and the French, that's an old trick of theirs to empower a minority tribe and to bring them along and therefore control the country through the minority rather as opposed to empowering the majority.
Yes, but look, the Ottomans did it also in Iraq. I mean, Iraq was, when it was ruled by the Ottomans, was ruled by the Sunnis, and the British essentially inherited that system and maintained it in Iraq. So it's, yes, colonialism does this, and colonialism, when you don't have the manpower to control large territories, you will look for allies, and it's always easier to find allies in a minority. And therefore, all colonial regimes will do that. And it is not specific, I think, to France or Britain or any other colonial power. I mean, I think all powers that dominate in the end try to find these kinds of linkages. And in Iraq, we did see a minority also that maintained power for a very, very long time. And the Sunnis in Iraq, until the fall of Saddam Hussein, were 20% of the population and control the whole country. And yes, it's a remnant of the colonial, but it's also a remnant of history. So we will continue. I mean, this is not unique to Syria.
Again, I'm speaking with Henri Barkey. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He's also served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. And he has an article at the American Interest spinoff, The Syrian Crisis and the Future of Iraq. Since we've been talking about Iraq, Henri, let's turn to your article at the American Interest. And it's a year since the U.S. pulled out of Iraq. And certainly the last thing one wants to reinforces the Republican notion, John McCain and others saying that we have to stay in there. The fact that it's starting to really look like it's going to fall apart is not to suggest that the U.S. should have stayed any longer than they were did, and they clearly were unwelcome. And the Iraqis called it Iraq Day, the day that the U.S. left on the 31st of December 2011. So how much is this, do you think, this unrest in Anbar and amongst the Sunnis and the heavy-handed way that al-Maliki said he's going to crack down on it, could this be the beginning of an unraveling?
It doesn't have to be, but it could be. There's no question that events in Syria are giving a lot of courage and encouragement, I should say, to the Sunnis in Iraq, who now see essentially another Shia offshoot regime about to fall in Damascus, and therefore they think that the Shia in Iraq will find themselves on the defensive, and this is a moment to push. And you see essentially the elements of miscalculations on both sides of the equation. That is to say, the Sunnis think that because in Syria the Bashar Assad regime is in trouble and it will be replaced by a Sunni majority government, that therefore they will get support from that new government and will be able to push their own agenda in Iraq. And the Sunnis in Iraq have yet to accept the fact that they are actually a minority in Iraq. Now, on the other hand, Maliki is also making a huge number of mistakes by being heavy-handed, as you said, by picking fights with everybody. And in the process, he's essentially deepening the divisions in Iraq, not just between Sunnis and Shia, but also between Kurds and the rest of Iraq, especially the Shia. And he's even creating, actually, interestingly, some divisions within his own Shia community. We saw this week Muqtada al-Sadr, the maverick Shia leader, who essentially went out of his way to criticize Maliki and support the Sunni opposition to Maliki. So it's very difficult to understand what is Maliki's strategy here. because the longer this chaos continues, and we've seen an uptick in violence, it's not as much as it was in the bad old days, but there is certainly an uptick in violence. Don't the week goes by when a bomb explodes in a few different places in Iraq, causing casualties? Although Iraq has a bright future because it sits on huge amounts of oil, it doesn't seem like the state is working. And the more it fails in delivering services to its citizens, whether it is energy, whether it is water, whether it is basic services from the bureaucracy, you will find that people are going to try to go their own way. And that's a big danger in Iraq. And there's no question that the Syrian crisis has also undermined essentially the border between Syria and Iraq. There is really no border between those two countries anymore. I mean, people are crossing. You have violent groups moving from Syria to Iraq, from Iraq to Syria. So you're seeing essentially the erosion of the state system, if you want, in that part of the world. I mean, the famous Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916 that drew the boundaries, the colonial boundaries of Iraq and Syria, which were artificial, admittedly, are now being questioned seriously. So, yes, the continuation of this and will, and or could, I should say, lead to a dismemberment of Iraq. And maybe that's why it should be. Who knows? But maybe something much better will emerge out of this. But it is not going to be bloodless. That's the unfortunate part of it.
And Henri Bakke, clearly, if there was a winner of the Cheney-Bush-Iraq war, it would have been, I think, the Iranians. And there's no question that al-Maliki is close to the Iranians, and the U.S. has essentially begged him not to allow Iran to overfly Iraq to supply the beleaguered Assad regime in Syria, at which the U.S. has failed to influence him in any way. So the Iranians are doubling down on their support for the Assads, and it would seem to me Iraq is as well. So what we're talking about, does al-Maliki recognize this possibility as much as the Iranians appear to?
Well, but I think to call the Iranians the ultimate victors, I think, would be wrong. I mean, yes, initially after the Iraq invasion by the United States, the Iranians essentially did emerge as the winners in this geopolitical game. But it was temporary. I mean, the thing about the Middle East and the rest of the world is that it's very hard to predict the future, as Yogi Berra once said. I mean, where the Iranians were on the upswing, if you want, after the American invasion, now they're on the defensive. Losing Syria is far, far, far more important to them than making the gains that they will be making in Iraq. Because, first of all, Iraq, in some ways, because it's a majority Shia country, is more likely to chart its own course than the Syrians, which had a minority government that really relied on outside help. Now, losing Syria strategically is far more important to the Iranians. The Iranians are the losing one at the moment because their connection to the Lebanese Hezbollah movement, which they have funded and have supported and in many ways made it into a fighting force, relies heavily on the Syrians because that's the strategic depth, if you want, of the Hezbollah movement is Syria. The moment the Syrian regime collapses, Hezbollah is going to pay a price. And Hezbollah is going to be on the defensive in Lebanon and will lose out in the long run. So effectively, the Syrian uprising means that Iran is losing both Lebanon and Syria. And so the gains that it will be making essentially in Iraq are also not that significant because, as I said, Iraq is still, if it stays together, it's still a far more a country that can rely on itself because it has oil, because it has a large population, because it has essentially a more coherent history, if you want. And it's not going to be that easy for the Iranians to dominate Iraq. Yes, they will use Iraq as a strategic threat, but imagine, I mean, where the most advanced outpost was on the Mediterranean, now it's going to be in Baghdad. At the best. So the Iranians actually are coming out as the big losers of this Arab Spring, if you want. And yes, they thought at the beginning when Mubarak and the Tunisian leader fell that, you know, this was going to be the heyday, but it's turning out to be their worst nightmare. And don't be surprised if the Iranians start thinking of a way to negotiate with the United States on the nuclear issue, because between these geopolitical changes and the sanctions, the Iranians are in terrible, terrible shape. They may not do it immediately. They may wait for the Iranian elections, presidential elections in the summer, and maybe after that you will see maybe a change in Iran, because I think the Iranians are in a very difficult position, like one they have never been in a long time.
So, well, Henri Barkey, is this a zero-sum situation? In as much as Iran appears to be losing now, does that mean that Saudi Arabia and the Gulf are winning?
That's a very good question. Yes, in some ways, especially the way they look at it. I mean, in the article, I said that the two sides are essentially in a Manichaean struggle, if you want, and they would perceive any loss by Iran as a gain for themselves. But look, the Arab Spring has taught us one thing, that no one is immune from pressures from below. You know, when you think about Assad, at the beginning of the Arab Spring, Assad got up and gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal where he was so arrogant. He said, "Not these things happen in countries where the regime is not responsive to the demands of the people. But here in Syria, we are, you know, we do exactly what the people want. We are in tune." And he said he gave this interview in February, and in March the revolt started. So Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries may sit pretty on a lot of money, but there is a lot of uncertainty. That doesn't mean that the regimes will collapse, but there's going to be pressure on the regimes, especially after the Assad regime falls, because people are seeing that, you know, they can overthrow regimes, they can put pressure, they can engage or force regimes to make reforms. And the Saudi government will also be faced with unpleasant situations whereby it will have to repress. It already is doing that in the Shia parts of Saudi Arabia, in the northeastern parts of the country. So we already saw in Bahrain the situation is quite dangerous, where the Shia majority is rebelling against the Sunni minority regime. That's another minority-majority crisis that has essentially now been put on the back burner because the Saudis have sent their own troops into Bahrain, and it's a small fish, it's a small place, etc. But it shows you that even in the Gulf countries, there are signs of unhappiness and there are signs of unrest. So, yes, in the short run, the Saudis will emerge victorious and will be very happy to see Assad go, and therefore the Iranians getting a black eye. But, you know, history continues. History doesn't stop with one event. And there will be other things that will affect the Saudis in different other ways.
Well, just in closing, it would seem, Henri Barkey, that if you compare Assad's phony democracy that he may have thought that he could sell to an interviewer, that he's responds to the will of the people, at least he had some semblance of a parliament. Saudi Arabia is an absolute monarchy. They are back in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, but look, I wasn't. Especially when you look at pictures today of after Bashar's speech. I mean, parliament in Syria was not a parliament. The fact that they had a parliament doesn't mean it was a parliament. I mean, just take 100 people off the street and put them in a building and tell them to raise their hands when you know the applause sign goes up is not necessarily a parliament. To me, there was really not that much difference between the Saudi and the Syrian regimes. In fact, one can make the argument that the Saudi control over its population is in some ways more subtle. I mean, they use religion, they use different forms of legitimacy, they use certain types of shura councils, etc. I'm not saying that this. What I'm just saying to say is that there was not much difference between Assad Syria and the Saudi regime. In fact, the Assad regime used far more violence to maintain power than the Saudis do. So it should
Right, but at the end of the day, I think
those kinds of comparisons are kind of dangerous sometimes.
Right, and not particularly useful. But there is a distinct difference, though. Assad is a fairly secular regime, and the Saudis, even though the royal family live in luxury and have all that oil money sloshing around, they do have a tiger by the tail with the theocracy that they created.
Look, fair enough. But secularism in of itself is not a virtue if it comes with brute violence. Sure. So what difference does it make whether you're being repressed by a theocratic regime or by a secular regime? At the end of the day, you're being repressed, and the outcome is the same. And my argument was that the secular regime in Syria is probably worse than the Saudi regime because it used much more violence.
Right.
That is not to say that the Saudi regime is necessarily that much better off, but let's face it. I mean, it does not use the kind of violence that the Syrians have used.
Sure. At this point, at least.
Right.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Henri Barkey. Very interesting discussion. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Henri Barkey. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He's authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Response to Globalization, Resistance, Application, and Alternatives. He has an article at the American Interest spinoff, The Syrian Crisis and the Future of Iraq. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the jobs report and how America's economy is basically an economy which is about profits, not prosperity.
It's all about strikes now, so it would strike.